Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, everybody. I'm David Green, here with Sarah Isger, Senior Editor at The Dispatch, and Mo Lathy, Executive Director at Georgetown University's Institute of Politics and Public Service. Well, during this recent election, and I mean, we should say for the last several election cycles, there is a narrative that has taken hold in our country.
There's a reason why Americans are more polarized than ever.
America's divisions are on troubling display.
America is a house divided, and in many ways, it always has been.
We have all heard how divided we are, but actually, according to a brand new poll taken after Election Day, Americans see their country as somewhat less polarized. We're talking about the Battleground Civility Poll that is run by your institute at Georgetown, Mo. It's conducted by a Republican and Democratic pollster. And when it comes to how much polarization Americans feel on a scale of 0 to 100, voters gave an average score of 66.5, which still high, but it's actually the lowest score since 2019. So yeah. What is happening?
Yeah, and to put it in context, zero being no political division at all, 100 being edge of civil war.
Extreme.
Ever since we started asking this question back in 2019, the mean score has been in the low to mid 70s, meaning that most Americans thought we were nearly three quarters of the way to civil war. And so we went into the field to poll after this last election and was a little surprised to see that this is the lowest we have seen. Since, I mean, look, still 66, right? People think we're two-thirds of the way instead
towards
of three-quarters
civil war,
yeah. of the way. That's not 100% optimistic, but it does feel like people think the temperature is being turned down just a little bit. And when you ask them, where do you think it'll be a year from now, the number's even lower. I think it's like around 61 or so. So there is this sense that folks feel like after this election, which we have all said was one of the most negative, was one of the most polarizing, with two candidates that everybody didn't like, that people kind of feel a little bit more settled than they have over the past few years.
I wonder, and Sarah, jump in, but I mean, the one question I have is whether there's something that just happens after an election that people sort of calm down and are like, okay, it's over. Thank God. We're moving on. Maybe it was the result I wanted. Maybe it wasn't the result I wanted, but like, can we just all relax for a second? Or do you see something deeper here that whatever happened in this election, Donald Trump's victory, it's making people feel a little less divided?
What you're describing was certainly not the case after the 2016 election. For Donald Trump, I mean, remember, we have the Pink Hat March nearly immediately in January. There was violence in D.C. on Inauguration Day. Obviously, January 2021, same thing happens. There was not this sense, like, the election's over, sigh, win or lose, time to move on. But for some reason, this time, it does feel that way. And of course, if you're sitting there listening to this and screaming at your radio, this wasn't a landslide election, but I would say it was a land shift election. What I think is causing that feeling is not that Donald Trump won some popular vote landslide, because it wasn't. It was the closest election. It may even prove to have been closer than the 2000 election between Bush and Gore when all of is said and done, but it was a shift universally. It was every swing state, every demographic group shifted a little toward Trump. And I think that has given people a sense of like, okay, that's where we're headed. And frankly, that sense of direction, I think, provides a little bit of comfort. Now, as I said before, Trump is not an American phenomenon. This is part of an international phenomenon, both populism, Trump-esque figures, and the fact that parties in power across Western democracies all lost altitude this year. It will be interesting to see moving forward whether that restlessness, that heading in the wrong direction feeling that Americans have had now for 10 years or so is calmed. We'll be able to see internationally whether that's the case, or whether, again, that tectonic plate that undergirds all of our elections in fact, means Democrats, we should think of as highly favored to win in 2028.
You know, I listened to you say it's people sort of settling into, okay, got it, this is where we're headed. Mo, just anecdotally, like, you know, I've heard some people on the left call it resignation.
Yeah.
Like a sense of, okay, this is where it's going. Could that be overlapping with a feeling less polarization if people are just like, okay, that's where we're headed, got it?
Yeah, well, look, I think part of it, and I think Sarah's right on a lot of that. After the 2016 election, right, Donald Trump was this new phenomenon. He was unsettling to a significant number of people. He lost the popular vote, and Democrats were looking at things like Russian interference and the Comey letter.
It wasn't what was expected.
2020, after the election, you did have, you know, the MAGA forces and their echo chamber screaming election fraud. And this time it was different. This time, everybody said, yeah, he won, she lost, period.
Hmm.
So where do we go from now, from there? So I do think that probably overlaps a little bit with it. Now, look, we're not in a great place, right? 66 as the mean score on, you know, the march to civil war is not a great place to be. But at least for now, we've been testing this since 2019. At least for now, people are willing to just kind of be like, okay. Now, it's interesting because also in the poll, we start asking questions about, okay, where do we go from here?
Right.
And people are very, very clear that they want Democrats and Republicans to actually work together, even with a trifecta. They want Democrats to be at the table. They want Republicans to reach out to them. And they say if they don't, they actually want Democrats to serve as a check on the president. Oh, that's all in this poll. So I think there's like this feeling like, okay, you know what? We're going to do this. We accept it. Some of us hate it, but we're going to do it. So do it. Work together. Because at the end of the day, the thing that propelled in our polling Donald Trump to victory was they saw him as the candidate who could get results.
Above all else.
Above all else. Kamala Harris was better liked in our poll. She had a net positive favorable rating. Donald Trump had a net negative favorable rating. She was better liked. She had, she was seen as less negative. Trump was seen as the more negative campaigner. She was seen as the candidate who offered a more hopeful vision for the future. All in the same poll.
He was also seen as the candidate who would be more likely to divide us, which is interesting given
right?
the less polarization thing.
He was seen as less likely to unite the country than she was. She was seen as the candidate who better understood people like me. She was seen as the candidate on all the major character traits. She beat him, except for one, which is the candidate that can get results. And on the issues that matter the most to voters in this poll, the economy, jobs, inflation, and immigration, they said he's the guy who can get it done. We don't like him. We're not sure he's going to be good for the country. But he at least will get things done. And now they're expecting him to work across the board to get things done.
Which takes us back to something that you've mentioned recently on the show, Sarah. I mean, this question of how Donald Trump and his team read the mandate that they mm-hmm. have. And what this poll, I mean, suggests to me at least is, you know, he clearly ran a campaign that gave voters the impression that he would actually do things that matter to them and their lives and their families' lives. But people are crying out for working together to get those results. Donald Trump likes to win. He likes to be successful. He likes to be the guy who gets stuff done. He also loves to go on TV and cause outrage. And, you know, you've mentioned before that this might sort of be like a split screen presidency, like what's being said on television and riling people up on Fox News and what's actually happening. Do you see this as a president who might read polls like this and say to be the guy, to be successful, to actually get results and not get literally destroyed in the midterms? I've got to, maybe not on television, but when it comes to Congress and actually doing things, actually work together? Or is that a fantasy?
So there's an interesting aspect to Donald Trump's leadership style that should lend itself to exactly what Mo's describing the American people want, at least as reflected in that poll, which is Donald Trump really does listen to anyone and everyone and take input from all corners before he makes a decision. Like, if you were to read some book on leadership, that would generally be seen as a very good thing, sort of a team of rivals type, you know, Lincoln-esque quality. But the problem is that, at least in the first term, the people who were willing to be around Donald Trump because of that polarization and the attacks that he was an illegitimate president, he wasn't really hearing from everyone, right? He's hearing from the people who are willing to be around Donald Trump. I wonder whether that will change this time. And in particular, I'm thinking of Elon Musk. Donald Trump, if there can sort of be a defining feature of his character, it's been a craving for acceptance in these elite circles that rejected him his whole life. And now you have the richest man in the world being on his team. And we've read stories in the news about friction between Elon Musk and some of the longtime Trump loyalists. I would bet Elon Musk wins that fight. And, you know, to your point about sort of a best case scenario, I think that's probably a pretty good sign for that overall. But this is where I will say something deeply unpopular, perhaps, on this show. This is also why I think Donald Trump should, within reasonable grounds, get every cabinet member he wants confirmed by the Senate. He has made major promises to the American people, big ones. Give him the team that he wants, and then hold him accountable for those promises. Don't give him the excuse that he didn't get the people he wants. He's already said, like, he can't blame the deep state anymore. He said he'll get rid of the deep state. He says he'll make the government efficient again, and that's going to be what cuts down on spending despite no entitlement reforms. Okay, let's see you do it. So if he wants Pete Hegseth and RFK or whomever else, again, with some reasonable bounds on that, like, yes, I'm for it.
Yeah, look, I don't know that I fully buy that Donald Trump will listen to anyone that will sit down with him. I think he will listen to and hear out anyone who sits down with him that likes him, that praises him, that kisses his butt, right? Like, that's who I think he listens to, are the people who flatter him. And then they can have a disagreement on policy, right? You bring three people who disagree on a policy and they're all, you know, fawning all over the president. Yeah, then he'll hear them out. People who don't fawn all over him, people on the other side, he's not going to listen to them very often, I don't think. I also want to go back to what we were talking about earlier for a second, because I do think we should not be sitting here thinking all is hunky-dory in terms of polarization.
No, we're not. Don't worry.
Because even though the number is lower on the Civil War scale, much of that drop was driven by Republicans feeling like there's less polarization, right? They are the ones. In 2020, when that number spiked, even though Democrats won, Democrats still felt anxiety. Why? Because they were looking at, you know, the long protracted voter fraud allegations and election denialism, and then January 6th happened. And so people were feeling very unsettled across the board. This time, Democrats are still pretty unsettled, and independents are still pretty unsettled, maybe a little bit less. Republicans are like, all's great, right?
They got what they wanted.
We won everything. And so there isn't that much polarization as there was before.
Interesting point of fact, for the first time in our country's history, at least modern history, more people identify as independent than Republican or Democrat. So from now on, when we say things like Republicans believe this and Democrats believe this, those numbers are shrinking. And as you're left with sort of this, you're simmering down to these like core, more extreme, more partisan people, the ones who are still willing to identify as Republican and Democrat. So the independents are becoming more and more important as you're trying to get the vibe of the country.
Yeah. And look, we've been saying all year that this was a vibes election.
Right.
What this poll tells me is that results trumped ideology, results trumped identity. People thought she understood people like them better. Results trumped civility. Results trumped feeling unified. I think results trumped vibes.
I told you guys you were overstating the vibes. Told you that. I told you that. You all were too into vibes.
At the end of the day, people were like, I don't like this guy. He still makes me unsettled. She's the better candidate, but he's the one who's going to get the job done.
But David, The vibes, actually, I think, were incredibly important. The vibes around change, mm-hmm. the vibes around whether this administration had been competent. I mean, Mo and I were sort of building a Maslow's hierarchy of election results here. And the bottom largest layer goes back. I mean, I'm arguing the 2008 financial crisis. Mo's arguing back to Watergate, right? But like this baseline government competency issue. Above that, you have the Democratic Party shifting far to the left with no sign of stopping over the last 10 years. Above that, you have the incompetency of a Biden administration that was hired specifically because people thought it would be competent. And then above that, you have the Harris campaign and all of the, you know, the mistakes that they maybe made, only having 100 days, all of that stuff is just this tiny part at the top. So I think the rest of that can be described quite a bit as vibes.
All right. Sarah Moore and I are going to come back after a quick break. We're going to pick up this conversation a bit, and then we're going to talk about Donald Trump's foreign policy and what are the results that he is promising to deliver and what might those results mean. We'll be back with more Left, Right, and Center. All right, we're back again with more Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Green with Moa Lathy and Sarah Isger. I wanted to pick up the conversation we were having with just one more thought question. And Moa, it's to you. What do you think of the posture that Sarah's talking about? This idea of, you know what? Don't give Donald Trump excuses if he doesn't get stuff done. Let him have the team he wants. Let him go after it for 2 years. Hold him accountable. And I'm assuming in the view of Democrats, like then he has no excuses and you can campaign like crazy and try and oust Republicans in the House and Senate in the midterms and then go after the White House. Like politically, how do you feel about that?
I get it. And there's something very tempting to be in that place. But when I look at a Matt Gaetz running the Department of Justice, or I look at RFK running HHS, or Tulsi Gabbard running, overseeing our intelligence community, or Dr. Oz running Medicare and Medicaid, that doesn't make me feel good. I don't want to see all the damage that they could do in those areas. Yes, I get it. Let the guy show us all that he's capable of and let voters then punish him for it. But I don't want all that damage. I don't want to see that. So I do think, and again, in our poll, voters specifically said, even though they want the parties to work together with the president, they still want Democrats, by a fairly comfortable margin, they want Democrats to be a check on the president. Now, I don't know how much of a check Democrats in the minority can be, but on some stuff they're going to. And I think that will also be, I mean, one, I think that's important for the country when Democrats see the president doing things that they just can't abide by, that they stand up to it. But two, I actually think that will be helpful politically for the party as it begins this effort to redefine itself. It's got to stand for something. And so showing where it actually draws the line is part of that process, not the whole process.
I want to shift topics a little bit. You know, Donald Trump is coming back to the White House facing a very different global landscape than in his first term. You know, we have the war in Ukraine grinding on. We have Israel's military campaign in Gaza and also Lebanon. We have Iran, the threat. We have China's growing influence. And, you know, we talk about Donald Trump. We talked about your poll, Mo, and how people want to get results. He's been making a promise when it comes to foreign policy to end all wars.
If we want great education, we want a strong and powerful military, and ideally we don't have to use it. You know, we had no wars, 4 years, we had no wars, except we defeated ISIS. We defeated ISIS in record time, but we had no wars. They said, he will start a war. I'm not going to start a war. I'm going to stop wars.
Sarah, what do you make of Donald Trump saying he's going to stop wars? What does that mean?
So let me start with what will sound like a slightly different point, but to me it's not.
You'll come around.
This week, J.D. Vance, the vice president-elect, tweeted out something about what a woman who works for Steve Bannon's podcast or Steve Bannon's media outlet had said about him missing a vote that resulted in a Biden judicial nominee getting confirmed. And J.D. Vance tweeted back, basically calling her a mouth-breathing imbecile who doesn't understand the basics of how the Senate works, that they would have gotten, they had 49 votes, so it didn't matter whether there were 45 Republicans there or 46 Republicans. 49 votes plus the tiebreaker in this case meant that person was getting confirmed. And so wasn't it more important for him to be interviewing FBI candidates rather than being the 46th vote instead of that person being confirmed with only 45 Republicans opposing? And once again, I saw everyone jumping on the calling her a mouth-breathing imbecile, then talking about, ooh, the intra-party fight, right, between the Bannon wing of the party and the J.D. Vance wing of the party and who was going to win out in the Trump administration. And I thought to myself, the vice president-elect just confirmed that they're interviewing FBI candidates, which means they're going to fire the FBI director who is appointed to a 10-year term.
I love that you're focusing on what really mattered there and all that.
Right? Yeah. That's the actual news. That's what's actually happening. And so I just level set. Anytime we're going to talk about this Trump administration, everyone, it's easy to follow the palace intrigue with names that people don't know and name calling and who's in power and who's out of power and rumors about what could happen next. I am going to work very hard to focus on the actual things happening, the FBI director being fired part of the news.
Good. I hope you hold us all to that. Yeah. No, I think focusing on the staying away from always the palace intrigue and focusing on what's really happening, I think is an important sort of landscape for us to continue to stay in. But go
so
on.
So when it comes to Donald Trump's foreign policy, right? I told you I'd get back to the point. I think that that will be really hard because there's all this rhetoric from his campaign, a lot of which is contradictory at times, by the way. You know, Donald Trump talks about, I will be your retribution, and then gave an interview this week that was like, I'm not looking for retribution. But then the people he hires says they're looking for retribution. Right? What does the word retribution mean?
Hold up. Yeah. So you're telling us Donald Trump isn't always consistent.
Yes. I know. This is newsflash.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm blowing your mind. So I don't know is the answer to your question, a very long answer. I apologize. But I think we should focus on actual events. Is he lowering or changing aid to Ukraine? Is he having Netanyahu here or having calls with Netanyahu about various ministers? Like, how involved is he in what's going on in Israel? And less focused on, you know, what it means to end all wars? I don't know.
Because the guy just says stuff.
He just says stuff.
And words do matter, but often they don't match exactly what he's going to do, as you're saying.
And the more you focus on the palace intrigue, the more you're not focused on what actually is happening. You know, the more you just call him like, oh, I mean, he's in Putin's pocket and all that. Okay, let's actually talk about what's happening. Why do you say that? What is the concrete steps he's taken? Not the rhetoric, not the nice things he says about someone or the mean things he says about someone. None of that actually matters compared to the what's happening.
Right. I find that terrifying in part to say like, oh, the president of the United States, the commander in chief, like don't necessarily pay attention to what he's saying when it comes to foreign policy, just pay attention to what he's doing. But with this guy, I mean, I hear you. Mo?
Yeah, I mean, let's look at, right, there's a handful of global hotspots right now that we should watch, right?
Closely.
And see what he does. In Ukraine, he has made it clear time and time again with his words that he just wants to get it done by any deal necessary. What does that mean? That means Ukraine's going to have to cede territory to Russia. That's what a deal means. Because the only other option is Russia accepting a deal in which they fully withdraw and take nothing new, which Russia's not going to do. So he has said that he expects Ukraine to cede territory. I think that's why the Biden administration this past week finally authorized the Ukrainians to use American-supplied missiles for offensive strikes into Russia.
Which infuriated Trump's team, right? Saying, like, you're doing this in the final days of your White House.
Honestly, I think it was to give Zelensky the best possible standing he could have when that deal comes. Again, almost a resignation that's not, okay, if what Trump is saying is true, and that's what you're going to have to do, let's get you as well off as we can. So what does he do there, right? Also, why is Elon Musk on the call with Zelensky?
Big question.
It's a big question. And not, I don't think that is just the palace intrigue, because I am very curious. They had Elon Musk on the call with Zelensky. Elon Musk reaching out to Iranian diplomats, right? How is that going to impact?
Let me just say, all right, you're listening to Left, Right, and Center from KCRW. All right, Mo, you were talking about the Zelensky, the phone call with Elon Musk, how Donald Trump is handling this conflict.
So let's look at what happens in the coming days and the first few weeks of the new administration when it comes to Ukraine. Israel, Gaza. This president has said with his words repeatedly that he's fully on the Netanyahu side in this. He's not really looking out for the best interests of the Gazan people, which, again, we all have, we've talked about this issue many times. I think we all can believe in Israel's right to defend itself, but there is a humanitarian crisis. He has not given much indication that that is a priority of his foreign policy, is ending that humanitarian crisis. And so what does he do in those first few weeks? I definitely want to see what he does there. Third, what's happening in Asia? Are we about to enter into a new trade war with a new round of tariffs with China? Probably. I mean, if past is prologue and if you believe what he says,
right,
his words, we're about to start a new trade war with China, which will increase tariffs, which will increase prices back home. That's something worth watching. But so is what are we going to do now regarding Taiwan? With his words, he has shown he's not going to be as staunch a defender of Taiwan as previous American administrations, both Republican and Democrat, have been. So in all of these hotspots, his words, I think, are giving us some sort of indication of the direction we may be headed in. But Sarah's right. Like, the guy says a lot of things. So we have to see in those first few weeks, particularly in those hotspots, where he takes
us. Well, and that's where I struggle trying to figure out how to interpret or believe. What am I saying here? I struggle with what you said, Sarah, about Donald Trump, because I really do understand why we should focus on actions. But I think about, I think about Taiwan for one thing. It's like, if Donald Trump ends up defending Taiwan as staunchly as President Biden, as previous U.S. presidents, then you can say like, okay, like what, his words that suggested otherwise don't matter. But if kind of the words now give China an opening to be more aggressive, and messages like that, when they're sent, cause other actors on the world stage, like China, to act differently. If him suggesting, hinting, saying that he's not going to defend Ukraine till the end,
he's
at NATO's
deal,
side, he's open to a deal, does that change Putin's battleground plan? And that's where I really struggle with the words thing. Because, when it comes to Ukraine, for example, look, if he makes some kind of deal that lets Putin declare victory, and Zelensky and the Ukrainian people truly feel like they have only ceded a little bit of territory. I mean, maybe Crimea, they have to just give up, as much as Ukrainians would be, horrified that I would say that. But like, they can feel a sense of dignity that they drew a line, they pushed the Russians back, they defended their sovereignty, and NATO stuck up for them. I don't care if Donald Trump takes credit, great. But like, if Zelensky is able to declare victory and say this was a victory for the Ukrainian people, and it's true, fine. But it's the other thing that worries me, that words give license to China, to Vladimir Putin, 100%. To do more.
Yeah, I think where the danger zone lies is there's words and there's a sense of strength, the peace through strength idea. And I think for a lot of Americans, they feel that the Biden administration maybe kind of said the right things, but projected weakness, and that actually has made the world a more dangerous place. And that a few things. One, Donald Trump is treated differently because he's Donald Trump. So for instance, on tariffs, I'm a free trade person myself, for what that's worth. But both Donald Trump, put in place tariffs against China, and Joe Biden left them in place. And so then it can often feel like when Donald Trump says something more outrageous, that's, it's like 12 economists say this is the worst. And it's like, there's no mention of the fact that that was actually the exact same economic policy under the previous administration, but the words weren't the same. And so we treat it differently. And then second, again, wouldn't be the way I would go about it, but there is at least a theory that Donald Trump's unpredictability is helpful for American power on the world stage, and that China is less likely to make an incursion into Taiwan because you just don't quite know what Donald Trump's going to do. Whereas you knew that Joe Biden wasn't going to fight a land war. We could have predicted everything that the Biden administration did in Ukraine. I don't think you can exactly predict what Donald Trump's going to do. And again, that lack of predictability, I think, is very uncomfortable for elites. And I don't mean that in the pejorative term, but like people who pay a lot of attention and are very invested. Obviously, for markets, not great. But when it comes to actual foreign policy, there's at least a theory that it can provide more stability when you have a single world power.
Now, look, I hear that. Studying international relations back in college, the rational actor theory was one of the things really drilled into you. When you're sitting down for negotiations, you kind of know what to do based on the notion that the person sitting opposite you is a rational actor. And when you look at like a North Korea, they're not. So it makes it unpredictable and a little bit more scary. I think for a lot of the world, yes, they do look at us and they don't think Donald Trump is the rational actor, which then makes it more unpredictable and a little bit more scary. I think there's some truth to that, but I don't know if that projects strength or if that projects instability. And I think, again, if you listen to the words, what Donald Trump has been saying does give license to Putin to say, I can keep this going, even if it's going to economically starve my people. I can keep this going because at the end of the day, that guy is going to force Zelensky to come to the table.
We'll see. We'll see. You know, one of the things that Donald Trump said right after he won re-election this time, it's maybe the first thing he said that I actually like kind of cheered for, like in my heart, is when he said, and to Hamas, if you're watching tonight, you better have those hostages back before I take office, or you're not going to like what happens next. I mean, I don't know that Putin is reading this as I can do whatever I want. What I would assume Putin's reading is this thing's going to be over real quick. So like everyone's shoring up their positions to get to that negotiating table, because one way or the other, this thing's going to end now. And the fact that the Biden administration wasn't able to do that is, it's at least worth debating those two foreign policy tactics. Mm-hmm.
I mean, what's interesting about the hostages thing is you could hear that in two different ways. I could see a lot of people furious over the bloodshed in Gaza saying, oh, he's just basically sending a message to Israel that they can keep going after Hamas in any way they want to. But also it could be putting pressure on Netanyahu to focus on getting hostages home and ending this thing.
Nothing happens until the hostages are home. There is no pressure to be put on Israel until they have every hostage back, including the six Americans. And that's, Trump was specifically referring to the Americans in this case. So there is no second step until the first step has happened. And again, it's something that just hasn't happened on Biden's watch.
In the couple seconds we have left for this conversation, let's talk about projecting weird. Elon Musk in that conversation with Zelensky and Trump? I mean, is, in a few words, reactions to that? I mean, should we be worried?
I got to wonder what Marco Rubio is thinking, right?
Like potentially the future Secretary of State.
Yeah. I don't love all of his positions, but he's a serious guy.
Right.
We're about to run the State Department. Did he know Elon Musk sat down with Iranian diplomats to start talking about de-escalating tensions? Did he know that Musk was going to be on the call with Zelensky?
Is Musk going to be sent on diplomatic missions with Secretary Rubio?
It sounded like it just accidentally happened, that Musk just happened to be in the room when the call went through, and so he hopped on the phone too. That ought to worry some of us. Nobody elected Elon Musk to anything. And if Elon Musk is going to become the shadow Trump whisperer on all things, that makes me nervous because we don't know.
Yeah.
I think that is the relationship to watch for the next several months. And don't forget, of course, Donald Trump could not pick Elon Musk as vice president because he's not qualified under the Constitution to be the president of the United States because he is not a natural born citizen. And so are we about to have a de facto vice president?
Oh, God.
In Elon Musk? But again, it's actually only been a few weeks. Let's watch the relationship.
Let's see what happens. And let's see whether or not Susie Wiles, the new White House chief of staff, has the ability to put some guardrails on
that. White House chief of staffs aren't elected either, and they can be incredibly powerful in different administrations. Yes. So, no. Look, I'm not freaking out or anything.
All right. Not freaking out. On that note, we will take a quick break and be back to talk about the future of the progressive agenda. We'll be back with more Left, Right, and Center. All right, we're back again with more Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Green with Moa Lathy and Sarah Isger. So as Democrats are continuing to reflect on what went horribly wrong in this recent election, some are saying that the party put way too much emphasis on issues such as protecting the LGBTQ plus community. Democratic Congressman Seth Moulton of Massachusetts told the New York Times, quote, "Democrats spend way too much time trying not to offend anyone rather than being brutally honest about the challenges many Americans face. I have two little girls. I don't want them getting run over on a playing field by a male or formerly male athlete. But as a Democrat, I am supposed to be afraid to say that," end quote. Now, there are other Democrats who are pushing back against the idea of scapegoating the LGBTQ plus community and the progressive left. Kentucky's Democratic Democrat in a red state, Andy Beshear, wrote an op-ed in the New York Times arguing that it's really about striking a balance. He said, "The Democratic Party must show the American people that it cares about creating a better life for each and every American. None of this means we abandon important values and principles. As governor, I have vetoed numerous anti-LGBTQ and anti-choice bills, yet I still beat Mr. Trump's hand-picked candidate last fall. That happened because even if some voters might have disagreed with the vetoes, they knew the next day I'd be announcing new jobs, opening a new health clinic, or finishing a new road that would cut 20 minutes off their commute. They knew my focus and effort was on their daily needs and that our gains as a Commonwealth would help every single one of our families." Mo, where do you align more? With Andy Beshear, with Congressman Moulton, or with another view here?
I want to read a quote from this week from Congresswoman-elect Sarah McBride of Delaware, who is the first trans member of Congress.
Right.
And after her election, she started facing all sorts of bigoted and terrible chatter, online chatter, and ridiculous juvenile taunts about where she'll go to the bathroom in Congress. And she put out a statement that began, "I'm not here to fight about bathrooms. I'm here to fight for Delawareans and to bring down costs facing families." Boom. Right? That's it. That's it. Democratic Party can and should, and I agree with Governor Beshear, can and should continue to protect the rights of all people. But we cannot be defined as only a party that fights for individual groups of people. Mm. And there is something about how you can fight for LGBTQ rights, how you can fight for civil rights, how you can fight for reproductive freedom without being preachy, without being condescending, and connecting the dots that ties all people together. The same, and Donald Trump showed us this, the fact that he was able to win more and more working class Black voters and working class Latino voters shows that the purely identity politics that rightly or wrongly defines today's modern left and today's Democratic Party doesn't work, right? There has to be a through line. And we can be the party that tries to level the playing field for traditionally underrepresented and marginalized communities without having to alienate every other community. And that's the struggle. That's what people did not see or hear from the Democratic Party over the past several, I'd say the past several decades, frankly. Even though we win some elections, we've been bleeding these voters because of that. Get back to the basics and voters will resonate. If we're talking about working class issues, we will get working class Black voters, working class Latino voters, and start winning back working class white voters.
Sarah, is that the preachiness is that Mo's describing? How do you see how the Democratic Party got into the position it's in that we're seeing this kind of infighting right now?
If there are Democrats who are blaming the LGBTQ community for their loss, they should be hit upside the face. Because
and I don't know if that's what they're all saying. I think they're saying that we somehow made our party identified by
identity politics. On this show. I'm going to just say that right.
Yeah, upside that's very the head, I will condone it because it wasn't the LGBTQ community that was the problem. It was all of the Democrats refusing to allow conversations. They would shut down conversations in the most shrill way. Well, you didn't use the language that I liked. Therefore, it's offensive. Therefore, you're not allowed to talk about it. Therefore, you're transphobic. That wasn't the LGBT community. That was mainstream Democrats doing that. So when Beshear talks about, like, you can veto this legislation and build bridges the next day, yes. But you know what he's totally leaving out of this is the language aspect, the cancel culture aspect, the refusing to engage in the conversation. I mean, this is right, the CNN conversation that went viral after the election, where the black man who's a conservative on the panel is trying to make a point about women's sports and protecting women's sports. And this white dude on the panel who's on the left says, stop, I cannot let you use terms like that. They're not boys, they're girls now, and we can't have this conversation until you use the language that I want to use. And the guy's basically like, I will use neutral language, but this is a conversation we need to have. And he says, no, we can't have this. And then the moderator of the panel says, well, we're just not going to be able to do this if you can't use language that's not offensive to other members of the panel. Hmm. Like, that's what this is about. That was not about the LGBTQ community or rights for the LGBT community. That was language policing and the arrogance and the faculty lounge aspect, where it seems like, you know, the fights are so big because the stakes are so small. You're really going to shut down a whole conversation about women's sports because you, random white guy, don't like the language and the pronouns because they don't meet your faculty lounge standards? That was the problem. So if you're scapegoating the actual LGBTQ community when you were the one not allowing the conversation, screaming about what you find offensive and what words people have to use, and trying to get people fired from their jobs if they don't use the words that you like, you were the problem.
Can I ask you both? There was a moment, and I hear everything you're saying, but it's you hit these moments, I think, when you feel in a conversation like you have to fight for someone. Like, and you have to fight against something that someone just said, because if you don't, you're not fighting for someone who you believe should be protected and fought for.
Sarah McBride can fight for herself, the new congresswoman-elect, Sarah McBride. And she just said, I don't want to fight about bathrooms. Well, I want to get done.
Well, this is to your point.
So stop speaking on her behalf. It's patronizing.
I want to ask you both about a memory I have. I was doing an interview during the Brett Kavanaugh Supreme Court confirmation hearings and was interviewing someone from the Trump administration. And he was talking about women in Congress, in the halls of Congress, who were confronting senators and said that they were shrieking at senators about this vote and what it could mean for them. And I stopped him. And I said that I did not think it was appropriate to refer to women who were trying to hold protests in the halls of Congress and describe them as shrieking. And it was a moment when I thought to myself, like, I am not sticking up for women in my life, my wife, friends, who would just be described by someone as being people who shriek just because they're protesting. And I'm wondering what you think. Should I have done that?
That's a mistake. I think that was a mistake.
For me to say that?
Yes.
I should have just let that go.
Yeah, language policing. Now, that's different than saying, I'm going to take away rights from women in the Senate. Then I think, you know, speaking on behalf of people for, again, it's actions versus words. It's the same conversation maybe I've been having this whole podcast today.
No, and you and I could talk for an hour probably about whether, and I still don't know if, like, literally hijacking the entire rest of that conversation to talk about that word and that I was offended was the right thing or not.
Because your audience can make their own judgment about whether they like the way that someone talks about something. It is not up to you to police someone else's language, to call it gendered or anything else, because it's not persuasive. And instead, it makes people feel like you're shutting down the conversation instead of pushing back on the substance.
But Mo, do you see where I'm coming from? Have you had those moments where I can't listen to that? But those are the moments, I think, in our society that are where the inflection points are
for sure.
Are going to be.
Yeah. Look, we all have these moments. And I remember a moment on this show that actually got cut out, that actually got edited out, when I
was talking about someone having, a woman having a very, you know, felt very emotional and passionate about an issue. And Sarah paused me and said, are you sure you want to use that word? You sure you want to use the word emotional? And like it immediately, like, I was like, oh my God, what did I just do? What did I just say? We all have these moments. We all have these moments. Sarah didn't say that to me because she knew I deep down was a sexist, right?
No, and really, to me, this is actually a good example because it was the opposite of the performative language policing. It was an off-air. I was like, hey, should we cut that? Because that's not what Mo meant. Oh. Now, if Mo had said, it is what I meant, and I don't think it's gendered, I wouldn't have said anything on air about his choice of words. It was that I thought he misspoke.
Right.
So there's something performative when you're like on the air or in the media.
When you're shutting down a CNN panel because you don't like someone's pronoun usage.
I'll say this, right? If I'm on a panel and it's happened where someone says, look at that woman candidate and her cackling or her shrieking or her, you know, I would kind of just be like, oof. Not a word I'd use, but let's get back to the issue, right? And that's a way to make the point. You would say
that's not a word I would use, but let's get back to the issue.
Oof, like I couldn't say that to my wife or sister, you know, and then get back to the issue. Because at the end of the day, if what we are doing is going down a rabbit hole of then turning it into a fight over what word to use or not, then we have taken our eye off the prize. We have taken our eye off of the actual issue that matters.
Which Democrats did, it feels like, in this election.
And I think there are ways to do what you're talking about, to actually call out when we think that there's something out there that will further alienate or disenfranchise or perpetuate bad stereotypes. We can point that out. But we don't have to then turn everybody into a villain for doing it.
All right.
Do what Sarah did. Give me a chance, right? Give me a chance to fix it.
Right. If it had been cable news, it would have been, you know, Mo, I can't believe you said that. And then Mo would have been back on his heels and like all of that instead of, you know, actually, it's funny. We're having a whole conversation about something we cut from a previous show.
No, but it's revealing. I'm glad you brought it up. Okay, we're gonna stop there, and it's time for rants and raves. Sarah, you want to get us started?
This will be perhaps a rant as old as time, but I'm here to rant about Thanksgiving erasure because in D.C., in New York City, the Christmas trees are up, LaGuardia Airport, Washington Reagan, everywhere. It's Christmas trees. The Diet Cokes already have Santa on them. Thanksgiving is my favorite holiday of the year, and how dare you intrude on my Thanksgiving holiday, a holiday that I will tell you I love because there's no commercialism. There's no presents. It is a holiday about sitting around with your family and eating food together, food that you have lovingly prepared. That's it. That's the whole holiday. My family, the main source of joy is actually the rolls that we make. And so no Thanksgiving erasure in 2024. I will stand up for my holiday of turkey and cranberries and rolls.
Can we taste some of the rolls?
They're going to blow famous rolls? Your effing mind.
What kind of rolls are it?
They're just
traditional dinner rolls, just, like fluffy and warm.
But there's so much butter. Just pounds of butter.
I'm gonna jump in because this is semi-related. I want to rave about holiday advertising. I love Christmas shopping, holiday shopping commercials on TV, streaming, radio, everywhere. The sad thing is when it happens this early, like I end up hating them, and that's so sad. Like it, I mean, I was in a mall the other day. There was already holiday music. My wife and I are watching TV and Target commercial. I mean, all about the holidays. I love them. I love the spirit. It makes me think of snow. It makes me think of fireplaces. It makes me think of hot wine. But like by the beginning of December, I'm going to just be sick of it. And that makes me sad because that's the time that I actually want to be enjoying it. So just stop. It's too early. Stop. I know it's an impossible and uphill battle, but just wait.
Yeah, I'm going to pile on here. Like there is literally nothing that is... I'm exhausted already, and it's not even Thanksgiving. I'm exhausted of music. And for all of you out there that now that are going to start saying we're trying to cancel Christmas, no, it's because we love the holiday season. So don't burn me out on it already.
The day after Thanksgiving is the best. I'm so excited about it. We get our real tree. I've already got Christmas ornament Legos for the 4.5-year-old so that he can like know that we're moving from Thanksgiving to Christmas. But it cannot come the day after Halloween. No, we do not move from spooky to Christmas.
No.
Thanksgiving to Christmas.
Also, I love Halloween so much. I need time to mourn its passing before I can jump right into
Moe's obsession into with Halloween is a little frightening. That's all I'm going to say.
Get it?
Okay. Sarah Moe, thank you. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Mark A. Green with production help from Kelsey Gante. Our executive producer is Arnie Seipel. The show was recorded by Will Salwin and mixed by Phil Richards. Big thanks to Digital Island Studios for always being a home for our show when we're here in New York City. Sarah Moe and I are all here together in person. Wish we could do that more often. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. Left, Right, and Center is a co-production of KCRW and Fearless Media, and we are distributed by PRX. I'm David Green. Come back for more Left, Right, and Center next week.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.